then I'm going to turn it over to our moderator.
Hi, my name is Loretta Ross, and I work at NOW, the National Organization for Women, and I work on their Women of Color programs. I will be moderating this program, but I'm going to start off with just a few brief comments. A lot of you might be surprised to find an abortion forum within an anti-rape week, and this is the first time we've done it this way. One of the main reasons that we're doing it this way is because it's very important for feminists to link up our issues. We no longer have the luxury of being isolated into one issue. We have to link up, we have to come together for strength, we have to come together for our own development, because it gets quite incestuous when you're only talking to people that think exactly like you do. And so we've really got to broaden the issues, and also we have to link up because it's very important to increase the number of women of color who are involved in defending reproductive freedom. And most of the women of color involved in the women's movement are not in the reproductive rights movement. They are involved in the anti-violence against women's movement. They are involved on poverty issues. They are involved on economic issues. So by linking up, broadening our struggle, we can make sure that we build a strong, viable network among women's organizations and among women of color. And I guess the bottom line for why we link up, and this is no surprise to anybody, is that we're all fighting the same enemy. The right wing that is against abortion is against all things that the feminist movement is doing. So that they're undercutting domestic violence programs by giving over $500,000 to Phyllis Schlafly's legal forum so that she can put out miseducation about domestic violence. They are really infusing the whole anti-rape movement with the conservative trend that's driving out the feminists who started that movement and replacing them with institutionalized alphabet soup people. By alphabet soup people, I mean they have PhD, LLD, MAD behind their names. And so we really need to understand that it is a tactic of the enemy to divide us, and we have to beat it, fight against that. I should also say that we really are in for some rough times in terms of our respective movements, the reproductive freedom movement and the violence against women's movement. And it's signaled by things like the recent nomination of Rehnquist as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. We're in trouble when a guy who is still caught up in 1930s ideology is going to be the major Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and he'll be dissenting on the fate of our lives. And I don't believe the lies that he's saying that, oh, I've grown up and I've developed. We don't see any signs of that. And the same right wing that's making war on Nicaragua, refusing to make war on South Africa, leading to poverty, unemployment, violence against women, these are all connected. I guess one could say, but then how is South Africa and Nicaragua related to abortion? I think they're related because it's all a matter of control, our control over our lives in every aspect. And when you talk about control of your life, you're not only talking about having a right to a life, you have a right to a certain quality of life. And our enemies seem to be pretty much determined that we don't improve the quality of our lives, in fact, that we go backwards. And so we have to really watch out for the manipulation of women's reproduction, because all around the world that is being manipulated for political purposes, for economic purposes. When they deny family planning aid to women in Africa who are suffering from a drought, from famine, and from starvation, that is a political manipulation of the lives of those women, and we need to recognize that. I think the pro-choice movement is growing, and it's growing because it is embracing women of color. It is understanding that it has to diversify. We can't be focused on just one issue. When we talk about reproductive rights, we have to talk about medical abuses. We have to talk about sterilization abuses. We have to talk about teen pregnancy, birth control, and abortion. You can't no longer be focused on that. And I think that's where we're going to really move into the future and really succeed in beating back this right-wing attack on our movements. I'll start by introducing our first speaker. Alice Kirkman, sitting on my far right, is the Public Affairs Director with the National Abortion Federation. And she is going to start us as we have these really great speakers coming from different parts of the pro-choice movement, talking about what abortion rights are for women and why we have to defend them. Alice?
Okay, thank you. It's very nice to be here. I'm the Public Affairs Director for the National Abortion Federation. Some of you may never have heard of us. We aren't a high-profile organization, but I think we're a very important one. We represent a lot of the abortion providers in the United States, clinics, facilities, feminist women help groups, health centers, doctors. Our members perform a little bit over half the abortions in the United States. And we try to promote safe, legal abortion. One of the things we do, we have a Truth About Abortion campaign going on right now. And it's a very important campaign to let people know what abortion really is, what the health procedures are, how it affects women's lives. We feel it's a very, very integral part of reproductive health care. Another program we have, and the one I'm going to talk about today, is unfortunately a necessary one, and that's a clinic defense program where we're trying to help our providers who are under siege by anti-abortion activists. If you don't have abortion facilities in this country operating, women effectively don't have a right to abortion because there won't be anyone there to help them make their decision and to have the procedure. Since about 1977, we've been collecting statistics on anti-abortion violence going on around the country. One of the sheets I passed around is what we put out every month, and it's a record of incidents of anti-abortion violence in the country. As you can see, it's been pretty serious, and it's still serious, notwithstanding what you hear in the media, which isn't very much these days. In 1983 and 84, there was a high incident of bombings and arsons of abortion facilities. That's still going on. In 1985, the total number of violent incidents was higher than that in 1984. And this year, while we don't have as many bombings and arsons going on, we still have an alarming number of extremely violent incidents. And we also have a high number of harassing incidents. And that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit today. The reason we keep these records is to keep this in the public eye. First, to let people know what's going on, and also to keep a record of this. We feel it's very, very serious. And we think it's a deliberate campaign going on. I think the anti-abortion movement is operating on two fronts. One front, which is the more moderate aspect of that movement, the right to lifers, is concerned with legislation, the courts, trying to restrict and cut back on the right to abortion generally. And they're doing this through the court system, through political appointments, through the media, a very sophisticated media campaign. The other, more radical fringe of that group is directing its actions toward abortion providers through constant harassment, violence directed toward these facilities, to really wear down abortion providers. There's a split within that movement. They're arguing among themselves about the best tactics. But today I'm going to talk a little bit about that extreme group that's directing its action toward the providers. Also, when you watch this movie, Holy Terror, that was made by a woman who followed around many of these anti-abortion activists for a year. She was going to do a very so-called neutral film, but as she got involved, she was so concerned by what she saw that, as you'll see when you see the movie, she decided to show what she thought was an alarming trend to link up the far right with mainstream politicians and President Reagan and really try to shut down the provision of abortion services in this country. Let me talk a little bit about some of the trends going on this year. There was a serious bombing in Wichita, Kansas in June of this year. That was a NAF member who was bombed. His clinic was able to resume services within a few days. And this is typical. It doesn't stop the provision of abortion services for very long, but it did happen. There's also been a very serious arson in Toledo, Ohio. That facility lost its lease. This is something you don't hear about once these acts occur. Frequently, the news media will pick it up. But what happens afterwards is that landlords get frightened, they terminate the lease, they lose a building, they lose their insurance, and it's a real problem. There was also a serious arson in St. Louis, Missouri in June also. And all of these acts occurred around the time of the Supreme Court's Thornburg decision, which came out this summer, which reaffirmed a woman's right to abortion, although by a narrow margin, a 5-4 vote. One thing that's picked up a lot this year, and perhaps this sheet doesn't show it as well, is harassment of clinic employees and doctors, and harassment of the women patients. Death threats, bomb threats, extreme picketing, clinic invasions are going on all the time. And it's something that doesn't always make news. It's old news. As you probably know, the media only picks up the most serious incidents, the bombings, the arsons. But I can tell you from talking to our members that it's the everyday harassment that's really beginning to affect people's morale. It's constant and it goes on, and the clinics feel isolated in some ways, that they don't have community support just because the community doesn't know about it that much. And it's a daily occurrence. Some of the things that have gone on, I can give you an example, and they may be extreme, but it's the kind of thing that clinic people have happen to them. A big tactic now is home picketing, to go to the neighborhood of a nurse or a doctor or a clinic administrator, and with bullhorns or picket signs, march around on the sidewalk, which is public property, in front of their house, making a lot of noise, carrying signs saying, Dr. So-and-so is a murderer, he kills babies, here's what he does or she does. And our members are calling us, and right now they don't have many legal remedies for that because of the First Amendment rights of picketers, but we're looking at ways we can restrict that. Some of the tactics are getting really silly, but they wear down. For example, a big tactic now is to order hundreds of pieces of equipment and bill it to an abortion facility. One person in the Denver area newspapers put in jobs available ads for a clinic in Florida. They didn't say it was an abortion facility. They said jobs started annual salaries of $38,000 a year. So hundreds of Denver area job seekers called this abortion facility in Florida looking for a job. And of course their lines were tied up all day and they weren't able to provide services to their members. Another very serious incident that just occurred in the South was one doctor received a phone call on his answering machine at the office that his oldest child had been shot by the police and would they please come down to identify the body. And of course, when you think about it, no coroner's office would really do it that way, but it sounded very, very realistic. The clinic was in turmoil. The family went through a lot of anguish before they learned it was a prank. That kind of thing goes on all the time, and it is a problem. Even though this is going on, there are things that can be done, and I want to talk about that a little bit. But first, before I get onto that subject, let me mention one thing that you may be aware of, but it's a type of harassment toward the women involved who are seeking answers about abortion and reproductive health. And that are so-called pregnancy crisis centers or bogus abortion clinics. I don't know how many of you saw the West 57th Street segment on this, but these are facilities that will advertise in a deceptive way, that they offer free pregnancy tests, abortion counseling. They frequently have a name starting with A so that they can be at the beginning of the list in the yellow pages. And women come into these facilities thinking that they're going to get counseling on abortion. And actually what happens is that they're told it will take an hour or so to do their pregnancy test. And they're put in a room and the door is shut and a horribly gruesome and deceptive film is shown. And there's a lot of propagandizing going on in the facilities. And sometimes these women are also telephoned constantly at home after they go to these places. These places have been funded by the far right. There are at least 200 of these around the country. Some people say more. It's really unclear how many there are. But this is a tactic directed toward women themselves. These places don't advertise honestly. They aren't the legitimate abortion alternative centers which counsel women in a non-threatening way. This is a new tactic that's pretty frightening. And one thing I passed around was our hotline number, which we try to circulate, and we get hundreds of calls a week from women around the country who want to know, have questions about abortion, want to know what facilities are near them. We are beginning to get calls from women who have just been to one of these bogus facilities. And if you could hear the fear in their voice when they've been to one of these places, and it's a tough decision anyway, it's frightening. You may have read about one of these places in the September 1 issue of Newsweek. They had an article on bogus clinics. But this is a harassment that's directed toward the women themselves and not just to abortion facilities. And it's pretty frightening. And we're trying to educate everybody about them. I don't know if I've gone over my 10 minutes. I get wrapped up when I talk about this subject.
You get a minute.
Okay. Unfortunately, there's not a lot going on at the federal level right now. The truth is, with this administration, that they're not taking a federal response to this, except that in the investigation of bombings and arsons, they have a very good Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which will investigate. Right now, most of the remedies are at the local level. It's subject to whether you have a sympathetic police force, a sympathetic district attorney, whether you have some good legal counsel in your community. We do find that when something has occurred, often once a community knows about it, they will rally behind the facility that's been subject to violence and harassment. And it's important that there be coalition building and working together. Our feeling is that it's very, very important to have legal and safe access to abortion. If any of you have ever been able to visit a facility operating, one thing you might realize is that in so many places in the world right now, abortion is going on, but it's not going on in a safe and legal way. If you ever have a chance to be in a facility and watch what goes on, the counseling, the time that's taken with women, the safety procedures, you'll realize that in so many parts of the world today, it is not done that way. And it's our goal that it be done that way everywhere. And we think that this trend will eventually go down, but in the meantime, it's important to rally behind with each other to try to stop it as best we can. And now I'll stop and let somebody else talk.
I neglected to introduce when we first started the woman providing signing for us. Her name is Bunny Olson from Sign Language Associates. Our next speaker is going to be Pauline Nunez Morales. She's Director of Education for Catholics for Free Choice, and she's been newly appointed to the Board of Directors for the National Institute for Women of Color, and she also works with the Mexican American Women's National Association here in Washington.
On October 1977, Rosie Jimenez died in South Texas due to complications from an illegal abortion. As you will remember, 1977 marked the year of the enactment of the Hyde Amendment, which withdrew the bulk of federal funding for abortions. She was 27 years old, Mexican-American single parent who attended college on scholarship and made her mark in history as the first documented case after the amendment. While this case is almost 10 years old, it continues to hold a special message. It reminds us of who or what kinds of populations are most affected by restrictions on public funding of abortions. Like Rosie, the women who are hardest hit by restrictive policies on public funding of abortions are Medicaid recipients, a program that finances health care for only the poorest of the poor, primarily mothers and children who qualify for aid for families with dependent children, AFDC. Current federal policy provides Medicaid funding for abortions only when a woman's life is endangered by continuing the pregnancy. Cases of rape, incest, or serious threat to health do not qualify a poor woman for a federally financed abortion. This has been the U.S. policy throughout the decade of the 80s. What are the effects of such policies? A Planned Parenthood Federation of America study estimated that 20,000 poor women each year carry to term pregnancies that otherwise would have been terminated. The National Political Congress of Black Women report that half of the 6 million pregnancies that occur every year are unattended or unwanted. Many poor women tend to have later abortions. One study found a 2 to 3 week delay in abortions among such women. The same study showed that 22% of the women who had second trimester abortions would have had first trimester abortions if funds had been available. In contrast, second trimester abortions among the general population have dropped from 12% in 1974 to 8.7% in 1980. Later abortions substantially increase the risk of harm to women. Each week of delay after the eighth week of pregnancy increases the possibility of complication by approximately 20% and the risk of maternal death by nearly 40%. Poor women who obtain legal abortions using their own funds suffer an undue burden. The $200 average cost of an early abortion is two-thirds of the average AFDC payment for a family. One study found that 22% of Medicaid-eligible women had to use money ordinarily spent on daily living expenses, such as food, rent, and clothing, to cover the cost of their abortions. What this means for women on public assistance is that she really doesn't have any legal recourse in which to terminate a pregnancy. If she's legally attempting to get an abortion, she really breaks the law in pursuing payment for the services, because if she secures a loan from relatives or friends, it's illegal for her to neglect reporting this additional income. And if she uses her public assistance funds for the abortion, this is really an illegal use of public money. Finally, the most tragic result of inadequate resources for women who depend on public monies for health services is that approximately 5% of indigent women resort to illegal or self-induced abortion. In some cases, like the Rosie Jimenez case, this results in the woman's death. Another critical part of the Rosie Jimenez story is her identity as a Mexican-American woman. Like many who share Rosie's cultural heritage and are classified as part of a larger group of non-white women, women of color, we find ourselves disproportionately occupying the lower economic levels in American society. Consequently, whenever there is a discussion about the lack of public funding for health services and the effect on poor women and their families, it is a discussion about that Chicana over there in South El Paso Barrio on the U.S.-Mexican border, or that Navajo woman out in a northwestern New Mexican reservation, or that black woman in the inner city of this nation's capital. In reproductive health care, the concept of choice is very significant. It means a woman's freedom to determine when and whether she will bear children, the right to bear a child, as well as to terminate a pregnancy. However, as June Inuzuka wrote in a recent editorial for the Organization of Pan-Asian American Women, what good is choice if one cannot afford it? What good are that choices cannot be communicated in English? What good is choice if access to prenatal care, legal abortion, and contraceptive education is limited? A universal concern for Hispanic, Asian, Native American, and black women is the lack of access to adequate health care for ourselves and our families, which makes the choice issue almost irrelevant. The worst case scenario of a woman having no choice in her reproductive life is a pregnancy that is the result of rape or incest. In effect, a public policy which does not allow funding to go to such a population forces women, sometimes young girls, to bear children. It creates an additional indignity forced upon the woman who has been the victim of a criminal act. The pro-choice position taken by the Indian Health Board and the resolution on reproductive health care written by the National Political Caucus of, Congress of Black Women stress two concepts respectively, dignity and personal empowerment. In the Inuzuka editorial I mentioned earlier, she encourages all women of color to take part in empowering ourselves to shape our choices. Restoring a sense of dignity and empowerment is a critical element of agencies such as the DC Rape Crisis Center. It is out of that sense of empowerment that must grow a clamor for justice in the public arena to grant funding for victimized poor women. Those who deliver services and have been the recipient of such services are the most effective speakers of the injustice of the lack of funding. Legislators, women's organizations, and caucuses on both sides of the issue need to hear from all of us. I challenge you today to speak out for public funding, to join campaigns to restore funding, read about the issue, learn from other women's experience, to assure that as we look at the anniversary of the Jimenez case next year, 1987, we can replace it with stories of hope rather than tragedy. And I want to spend most of my time allocated for speaking really in passing out a resolution and a fact sheet on the Justice Campaign, which is a group of religious leaders who are asking for your support of a campaign to secure public funding for abortion for Medicaid-eligible women whose pregnancies result from rape, incest, and child sexual abuse. So if I could pass these out, I really would like people to look over it. It's the fact sheet. Okay. And my organization, Catholics for a Free Choice, is supporting this effort.
Is that it?
That's it.
Thank you. Our last speaker today is Gay Williams. Gay is the press officer for the Religious Coalition for Abortion Rights. She's a founding member of the National Political Congress of Black Women that was referred to in Pauline's speech, and is an artist, an actress, and a terrific speech giver. So we put her last.
Right.
Gay.
Put her last if you see how much time there was. That was a terrific speech. Pauline really hit the major considerations in Medicaid funding, which is a project that the Religious Coalition for Abortion Rights has been wanting to have on the top burner of the pro-choice movement for a long time. And we're also working with Catholics for Free Choice in making this become a reality. We got screwed by the Senate about a week ago, and we could probably answer questions about that later if you like. But I want to talk today about a more ideological question, and the name of the speech is The Power to Choose Life. And I think I have enough time to do most of it. I'll try to go through it. Throughout history, women have been portrayed in many different ways, as mothers, as educators, as symbols of the best hopes and the highest aspirations of our society. The Statue of Freedom on the Capitol Dome is a woman. The scales of justice are held by a woman. The Statue of Liberty is, of course, a woman. But the current administration is, of course, representative of a social movement which argues, in religious terms, against a woman's capability for making responsible moral decisions on her own behalf. So we see that the anti-choice, and I would argue anti-religious liberty movement, is becoming increasingly adept at hindering a woman's power to choose life, not only through direct action that Alice talked about, but by their refusal to accept women as responsible moral decision makers. We have looked today at the kind of the external things that the anti-choice movement is doing to actually prevent women to make a choice. But I want us to look also at another even more insidious way that they are limiting women's ability to choose life. I think they're more insidious and they're more dangerous because they are ultimately harder to combat. They are ideas that have begun to seep into our collective consciousness. They affect the very way that the public reasons and thinks about family planning and abortion issues. The American public doesn't seem to have much difficulty finding abortion clinic bombings despicable. If you ask people, they say, well, this is terrible. But they are very uneasy about the religious fanaticism evidenced by the anti-choice movement. but a recent poll conducted by the Planned Parenthood Federation shows the following results: that hardcore pro-choice people represent 30% of the country, and hardcore anti-choice people represent 21%. Well, that leaves 49% of the public with less consistent views, who see merits in some of the arguments on both sides. And that 49%, which we call in Washington the mushy middle, is who each side is trying to capture. What are the dangers? What are the threats that are posed by the anti-choice movement? I think the answer is that they have had some success in creating a very powerful public message. They have infused and diffused their images and ideology into the American social fabric. Their phrases send quick, often subliminal messages. Their rhetoric is combative. Their imagery is grotesque. They capture people's imagination with visual images which portray all abortions as third trimester abortions when nothing could be further from the truth.